I've got an easy source of geothermal. Yes, if you go down deep enough with a good well drilling pipe, you'll find some pretty hot stuff. The earth is a relatively constant temperature when it goes down a ways. So when we get it back to Eric, he's going to give us some comments on all this. The person who said comment, who was that? K2LAW.net. My name's Dick.
Yes, K2LAW.net. I think solar power is the answer. A few months ago, I saw a program on TV about it. And at the present time, they claim solar power costs a little over $10 a watt to buy and install. And they've come up with a way to produce solar panels for less than a dollar per watt. Can be made in any shape, and they can produce these just about as fast as you can print newspaper. And the other thing is battery technology has come a long way, and it's improving rapidly every day. So I think solar power eventually will be the answer.
I'm with you, Rich. My favorite, by a long shot, is solar. On the latest issue of Machine Design, Electronic Design News I was issuing, they're talking about a company that's making solar cells more and more and more efficient by increasing the amount of area required for the laid down silver that does the conducting between the individual cells and so on. The company's name is 1366. Why that number? That's the number of watts per square meter that the sun hits outside of our atmosphere with. 1,366 watts per square meter. What gets down here through the atmosphere is closer to 1,200 watts per square meter. I've got an acre of Huntington. At high noon today, 4.3 million watts of solar energy hits my property. Boy, I wish I could collect 1% of that. 43,000 watts. When we burn hydrocarbon fuels, whether it be oil, gas, coal, you're burning the result of a past solar event. That's where the fuel came from. The raw energy is coming from the sun. It's time we go to the horse's mouth. When we make solar cells big enough, prevalent enough, cheap enough, one hell of a source of energy that's hard to deny. And you know what the Germans are doing. You guys have heard this from a PBS program. For every kilowatt hour of energy you can get from a renewable source, most of it's solar voltaic, some of it's wind, that you pump back into the German grid, they will pay you 50 cents a kilowatt hour, guaranteed for the next 20 years. My goodness, is that an incentive. That's one hell of an idea. Eric, what have we got to do other than your program on the subject to make that idea popular in the United States? KE2EJ, KQLIW, the tech man.
It's working.
Aren't you recognized? Eric first.
All right. First of all, let me give you an example. All right. That's absolutely wonderful. Don't forget, solar panels are currently the way they are, anywhere from like 12 to, I think, 18% efficient. It also takes energy to make them in the first place, but because as you use them, you overcome that. So let me give you an example of a current solar panel. 195-watt solar panel produces 24 volts, about 8 amps. It's 66 inches by 32 inches and about 2 inches thick. Okay, not in quantity, singular amounts to $899 a piece. Okay, so that's 195 watts. 195 watts. Now, not only do we have the solar panel, but geez, if we're going to run some appliances, we're going to have to turn it into 110 volts, 120 volts. So we're talking about an inverter. And a lot of the inverters that they sell today, at this point in time, okay, I'll give you an example. They particularly come in 2,500 watts, 4,000 watts, 5,500 watts. They run anywhere from $2,000 to $6,000, depending upon who you buy. The more panels, the more inverters, and that's without even talking any kind of batteries. You can add batteries to it later. There's there's always a good source of batteries, at least that I've found. That's called a railroad yard. you're going to have lead-acid batteries that have thousands of amp hours, and you can go that way. But, you know, that's one of the reasons why the panels are so expensive when they drop. It's an age-old story about what business wants to do and where they would rather sell their SAM. Okay, by the way, this guy, Oshetsky, who invented the nickel metal hydride battery, he is actually now producing in large quantities stuff that looks like roof shingles that you put on your house. It's flexible. It's a little less efficient than the glass solar panel. You can run nails through the damn thing and nail it to your roof. And it's actually catching on in other places in the United States. He's got it as an assembly line. It's sort of like a quarter of a mile long, and it just rolls out like tar paper. So there's a lot of good stuff happening, but as far as the investment, when people see what kind of money it takes, they're kind of like, whoa, it's going to take me 10 years to make it back. Well, you know, the average life of a house, of a family in a house, is 30 years. So there's 20 years of free electricity if you do that. Back to you, Dick. I love it.
My favorite is solar voltaic. Now, Lou, when you teach your students about the power of the sun and the benefit of solar voltaic and other kinds of renewables, how difficult was it for you to get the point across? N2RQ, KQRIW?
Well, you have to understand, I haven't been working directly with students for a few years, but I have been at a number of meetings, and there's a constant theme that keeps coming up. At one meeting at Hofstra University, Environmental Science, Environmental Chemistry Symposium, not this spring, but last year, we had a physicist from Brookhaven National Lab, and in the fall of last year at the Chemistry Teachers Club of New York and the Physics Club at NYU, we had a guest speaker who is formerly of Polytechnic University of Brooklyn, but currently lives in London, and is on, I don't have the name exactly right, but I don't remember. He's on the British Commission for Sustainability. And there's a theme that keeps coming up, and that's why I jumped in, because you're looking for photovoltaics, and Eric had mentioned a number of other things. You know the concept of the silver bullet? Everybody's looking for a silver bullet. And these guys have come up with a different theme. They call it silver buckshot. And they come up with the fact that numbers are so large that we need them all, or virtually all, to solve the energy problem. Each one of these is not enough to meet all the demand. Dick?
I agree with that. You got to do them all in parallel. If I was living near the Bay of Fundy, where they get, what, 20 or 30 feet of change in the tide, I'd like to have wave energy. If I'm living in Iceland, I'd like to be using geothermal into electricity conversion techniques. If I'm living in Arizona, I certainly want to be using photovoltaics. And if you allow me to use 1 million volt DC wiring for the distribution, I mean just the transmission of power, I can now do it quite a bit more efficiently, even though I'm going 1,000 miles. That's what Canadian Hydro does. They transmit plus and minus half a megavolt, plus half a megavolt DC, and minus half a megavolt DC. And they got a kind of redundancy in their system. Very efficient. Because nowadays, inverters are not that difficult to make. Eric, you told us about inverters of multiple kilowatts, which are reasonably expensive sounding. I have a gut feel that the raw components that go into one of those inverters are not that high. And if QSC Magazine told us a good schematic diagram of an inverter that we could build with our own hands, because people like you and I think we're crafty enough to do that, I'll bet you we could cut down the price of that by 4 to 1. What do you think, Eric?
Well,
gauge. Oh, by the way, I don't want to store the energy locally in batteries in my house. If I've got excess energy and local, LIPA can always use more, I'm going to pump it back into LIPA. By far, that's the most efficient place to put it, rather than into batteries in my own house. I'm not trying to remove myself from the grid. I'm trying to make a more efficient operation between me and the grid and the dollars that I sell spend on kilowatt hours. I'd like them to start paying me for the photovoltaic energy I'm going to get, and now I'm going to invert it with the circuit that you and I are going to invent. How expensive are the raw parts for that inverter, in your opinion, Eric? K2EJ, K2LIW in the TechNet. K2LIW, K2EJ.
I'll give you a hint on that. I actually have a 175 kVA inverter at work, which powers everything. There's three phase and 480. And actually, believe it or not, we could probably build something like that without too much problem. That's a big issue with inverters, and actually that technology is now changing with the way we do buck and boost. There's better ways of doing it than has been done in the past. Probably could put together, let's say, a 1,000-watt inverter that would work with the grid, because you have to phase to what's coming in. You can't just arbitrarily put AC into a line that's got AC in it and expect everything to be all happy. It's got to be perfectly in phase, and you really want to make the switch during its zero crossing so you don't destroy everything from all that inlet current. By the way, LIPA will not help you if you put batteries in. If they find out that you put batteries in after they've helped you, they'll ask for their money back. The idea is communal, in terms of that if you and I are making excess electricity and we're providing it back into the grid, that means that LIPA has to put in a little bit less energy, and we're kind of sharing it. We're giving it to our neighbors. We're not giving it to them. They're paying for it, but... Because we've all become a little business, we charge them instead of them charging us. So with that in itself is a good thing, but I also like the concept of being off the grid. By the way, there is something that really there hasn't been too much effort been put into, and there are some people now who are beginning to get the point again, and that's to use Stirling engines. Because when you talk about geothermal, if you go to a place like, say, Salt Lake City, Utah, there's all these nice hot springs up in the mountains. You can get water temperatures to superheated steam, and not necessarily an active volcano. There are places on the Earth where the Earth's crust actually comes into contact with some of the molten magma that's underneath there. But I'm talking about differentials in temperatures that are only as much as 10 and 15 degrees. There are actually little demonstration Stirling engines that will work off the heat of your hand. Not very much power, but when you start to do that on a large scale, that becomes something interesting. Let me drop one more thing. Okay. And when we talk about solar, we're generally talking about photovoltaic. We can do much higher efficiency by using solar concentrators, and there's a various different methods of generating energy from solar concentrators. You can make steam and drive turbines, which they're doing in California. You can do direct conversion through a mechanical means, such as a Stirling engine. For example, at the University of Nevada, they have a big mirror system that drives a big Stirling engine. It generates, I think, around 25 or 30 kilowatts, something like that. And it's about a small operation. They have a big one that I think generates about 80 kilowatts. So there are more methods than what is just normally talked about. And believe it or not, in Hawaii, the NREL lab that's there, there is a whole area on the Big Island that's concentrating on not only on geothermal, but because of all the sunshine that they get, they're very efficient going to solar. K2IWKUJ. Yeah, Hawaii's got lots of sun, lots of volcanoes, lots of wind. There's one other source of energy that was brought to my attention. Dick LaRosa, who's one of the consultants that I see every month at the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network. He's a real enthusiast when it comes to what's going on with oceanography. And if you take a look at what's called the North American Gyre, you and I would know it as the Gulf Stream. There's a continuous flow of water from
roughly the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico, up the east coast of Florida, up the east coast of the United States, across the Atlantic Ocean, over toward the United Kingdom, and it goes through a great big circle. It's powered by the, you could call it the solar energy hitting the ocean, creating temperature differences, and that combined with wind makes a continuous flow of water with many gigawatts of power available. You just put some turbines below the surface, anchored offshore in Florida. You would never see them on the surface. They would be an NIMBY problem where someone says this thing is ugly. It's the equivalent of a wind turbine, but it's below the surface of the water. And lots of gigawatts of energy is there, ready to be tapped into. So there are sources of energy, all solar powered, all immediate. You're not burning past solar events like when you burn natural gas, coal, petroleum products. You're burning past solar events. And I would be a bit surprised if we did a careful calculation. Something in the vicinity of 1,000 years of past solar events mankind is using up per day. That gives you a strong hint. I may have the numbers 10 to 1 wrong, but it's in that ballpark. 1,000 years of past solar events we burn per day. Gives you a little bit of feeling for the fact that we're using these fuels of opportunity. Petroleum is a nice, compact, available fuel now, although we're starting to pay a heavy price for it, and I mean that in 3 different ways. We got to wean ourselves from just that particular fuel, so to speak, if at all possible. So there are other ways that we can tap into what the sun is giving into us free of charge for the last 5 billion years. We have good reason to believe for a good fraction of the next 5 billion years, the sun will continue to do it. Time to go to the horse's mouth. The guy who started this all off was Charlie, KC2MIT. Charlie, I bet you didn't realize what you're going to kick into operation here tonight with your seemingly simple-sounding question about fuel cells. Let's see if Charlie's got a couple of comments on all this. Boy, did you start a war. KC2MIT. K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2MIT. No, I did not. And I'll bet you there's a group on the air right now that said, why did I ever open my mouth? Well, actually, it's fantastic where the information goes and how it's, you know, the knowledge is spread over this group. I've listened since I've been on the air since, about last Christmas. And it's just fantastic. A wealth of knowledge, and you guys are absolutely super. But I'm sorry I threw a grenade into tonight's tech deck. So with that, I will be listening out, and I'll send this back to net control. I'm sorry for what I did.
Yeah, this tech net has existed since September of 1982. We get together every single Sunday night at 8 o'clock since September of 1982. You guys are listening to TechNet number 1197. It used to last an hour, and they now average closer to 4 hours. And believe it or not, there's an extremely enthusiastic individual named Mike Perry, KT2, November, Juliet, India, who has created a website that has recorded every minute, per se, of the TechNet for the last, I think he started somewhere around 2006. And most of the TechNet since 2006 or 2005 are documented. You go to the website of www.amateurradio.television, amateurradio.tangovictor.tv, amateur radio with all run together, amateur and radio, 2 hours alongside of each other, amateur and radio, .tv, and you can look at all the past techniques, and they're documented. When they're more than about a week or two old, they'll tell you every 3 minutes what subject is being discussed. You look at the documentation and say, oh, that's a subject I want to hear about. And those guys were talking about it on 43 minutes into the second reel. each reel is an hour long. Go to the right reel, and 43 minutes into that reel is the subject you want to hear about, and you go there, and there it is. The price is right. Didn't say it's all accurate. Didn't say it's, in the vocabulary you want to hear, but they're all documented. It's amazing to me. I've been hearing stories that there are some college professors of technical school in New Jersey that are recommending that their students listen to the TechNet in order to get a smattering of what the real world of electronics is like among the people that are touching it, smelling it, feeling it, and discussing it. And thus, we amateur radio operators. Let me drop for a second. I'm also discovering that if you really want an antenna engineer, you don't go to MIT, you don't go to Stanford University, you don't go to Georgia Institute of Technology, you don't go to the Institute of Chicago University, you go to a ham radio operator. Antenna engineering, a very valuable kind of engineering, is not taught in our schools. They give you a smattering of Maxwell's equations and the field and wave course. That doesn't allow you to be an antenna engineer. We amateur radio operators tinker with antennas. We got a gut feel for how they work. They're a little bit mysterious, so we discuss that. I'm working for various organizations as a consultant, and when we need an antenna engineer, the first thing we look at is what's the guy's experience, what's his education, and is he a ham? And if he's a ham, there's a 90% chance his feet touch the ground, he's practical, he's touched antennas, he knows what they look like, he knows how to tweak them. He's a valuable human being. Go grab him. Eric, I wonder if you needed an antenna engineer, where would you go? KE2EJ, K2LAW in the tech net.
I'd probably call you. it's the kind of thing where that it's just my own experience has helped me in the things that I do, even with the broadcast stuff. Well, I got to admit, broadcast antennas are a bit of a strange animal. They do stuff that we don't even think of because they do it at such high power. Who would think that you have these bow tie antennas that they look pretty? They're all ground. I mean, where do you stick the RF and make them work? You know, that kind of thing. But it can be fun.
Yeah, one of the strange things that I've discovered, when you study the Antenna Engineering Handbook, and it's now in its fourth edition, and the latest one is by Volakis, the previous one was by Johnson and then Jasek, and I've worked with Henry Jasek. He used to run the Jasek Antenna Laboratory, along with, I can't think of his name, his chief engineer, who I took courses under. Anyhow, every single piece of metal, I don't care what the hell shape it's in. If you can take a piece of metal of any particular length and you put an interruption in it, that's called a slot antenna, or you take that piece of metal and you bend it some kind of a way, if you're smart enough, you can make it into an antenna. There are 5,000 kinds of antennas, and I'm not kidding. There's 57 chapters on just the various classes of antennas written by 85 experts in that particular field, of that particular kind of subset of antenna in that latest Antenna Engineering Handbook. The damn thing is, I think, 1,100 pages, 57 chapters, and boy, they cover the waterfront. My biggest complaint is I wish the book was larger in format with larger type, because now that I've got the more than 60-year-old eyes, even though I've got bifocal glasses, I'm having trouble reading the fine type. I wish the book was bigger, larger format pages, with slightly smaller number of pages, because I think the binding of the book is, unless it's made super strong, I worry about the darn thing falling apart. Each one of my antenna engineering handbooks, which get used every single day, my first, second, and third edition, are very beat-up looking books. They get dropped, they get loaned out to all kinds of people, they get ripped pages, they get marks in the pages, they get notes left taken, they get pieces of paper stuck in the pages, and 3x5 cards and whatever. So it's a heavily used book. But that's an art and a science and a black art. You almost have to make a Faustian deal in order to become a good antenna engineer. The schools do not teach that subject. Let me drop for a second. This is one of the areas where I've got a lot of heat under the collar. We teach every electronic engineer who's going to get a bachelor's degree or the equivalent We teach him a fields and waves course. We teach him about RF energy, how to generate it, how to measure its standing wave ratio, how to detect it, how to modulate it in angular or amplitude, in phase, out of phase, how to do digital modulation, all kinds of RF techniques. We teach our students. There is no reason in the world to generate RF energy unless you're going to transmit it with an antenna through empty space. Nobody in his right mind would bother generating RF energy if you're not going to transmit it. There's a slight exception to that rule, and that's the cable TV system, where it's not broadcast, it's narrowcast, so to speak. But with that exception, there's no good reason to create RF energy. And that cable TV system is just a substitute for what used to be over-the-air broadcast. You're going to connect it to an antenna, ultimately. Otherwise, you're not going to bother generating it. So to teach everybody all of the nuances of modulating, demodulating, generating, calculating, standing wave ratio, impedance matching, filtering, to teach all of this jazz, zillions of subjects about RF, but don't teach them the thing that every one of those pieces of RF per se is going to be connected to, an antenna. And you don't even mention the word antenna until the last week of the senior year of the electrical engineering course. Tell me that's not crazy. Wild. How the hell have we done that since World War II and haven't yet corrected it? The number of schools on planet Earth that really teach that art and science, I can count on one hand. And they do a mediocre job of it. They just barely do the stuff that can get to the doctoral level. Why so late? You try to hire an antenna engineer that's worth his weight, worth the salary you're about to give him, and you'll suddenly discover that's a rare animal. That's a strongly felt opinion that needs corrective action, in my opinion. Anybody got any comments? And when it comes down to the situation, give me a call at us right now, KQLIW in the tech man. Go right ahead. It's www.
Can you give a repeat on the website with the archives of the TechNet?
Yeah, there's a small fee involved. My goodness, I'm looking at my password here, and I don't see your name immediately. I'm going to have to look you up. Tell me your name, sir.
I'm sorry, I think your name is Tim.
Yes. I got a lousy memory for names, as you can tell, Tim. You go to amateurradio.tv. That's it, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. That's it. You go to that website, and you'll see that Mike Perry has recorded the technical net for quite a few years, as well as the technical net for New Jersey that's run by W2TTT Gordon on 146.39 on Thursday nights at 9 o'clock, as well as two other nets, scanner nets and whatever. Wherever there is a repetitive net of some kind that's got technical data, Mike Perry's recording it, documenting it, and there it is. I don't know if you still got it, but there was a section there on the TechNet page where you could go directly to the lectures that were given by K2KEY on the subject of Smith chart calculations. At one time, I don't know if he still got it there, but he did have that. He also had the picture of me on my tower that's in the, I think it was the April issue of CQ Magazine. That was on the page there for a while. Interesting stuff. Tim, do you need a fill on that?
I'm having a little trouble pulling it up. I'm spelling amateur, A-M-A-T-U-R-E. Am I on with that or am I off?
A-M-A-T-E-U-R. A-M-A-T-E-U-R. R-A-D-I-O, all run together, dot Tango Victor. Amateur Radio, A-M-A-T-E-U-R, R-A-D-I-O, dot Tango Victor. Back to you, Tim.
Yeah, sometimes I get that mixed up.
Yeah, if you have any trouble finding that, Tim, just come back to us. But lots of information there. Now, the only complaint I've got is that some of the recordings, because he's in New Jersey and we're out here on Long Island, some of the recordings are a little bit low in signal-to-noise ratio. I think there's also a compacting going on. We're talking about 4 hours per TechNet per week being recorded at the millisecond level. So we're talking about megabytes of data here in these audio recordings. So I think some kind of compression is taking place. A few of the recordings are high fidelity, and some of the recordings are a little bit lower in fidelity. But the data is there, and the price is right. And we keep meeting here each week. Mel and I are amazed that there's that many people with that much enthusiasm writing us emails and telling us what they like, what they don't like, making suggestions, answering questions. What amateur radio operators are not only wireless electronic tinkerers, experimenters, engineers, whatever. They are, in my opinion, first communicators. We talk to each other. We compare rigs and antennas and feed lines, transmitters and receivers, and methods of modulation and packet propagation, whatever. We share information. We share lifestyles. If you're talking to guys with in a foreign country, let me drop.
It's working.
Lou recognized. We share lifestyles, but we share information. We communicate. And if you want to be a good speaker in front of a group of people and convey information, what better way to get the practice than to sit in front of a microphone and talk to either one or zillions of people, depending on how many want to listen to you, and try to boil it into a vocabulary that the majority will understand what in the world you're saying. Hey, Lou, you've stood in front of a class a few times in your life. I'll bet you some of your ham radio experience has helped you be a little bit more communicative. That's the pigeon. KQRQ, KQRIW, KQRQ, KQRIW.
The space station is supposed to go over again. Is it visible, and in what direction should I look?
Okay, the person who brought that to our attention was Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Delta. John, are you available to tell us when the next space station overrun is going to take place? What I recommend you do, Lou, is go to Heavens Above. HeavensAbove.com. You may have to Google it if you don't have it exactly right. And you dial in just your area of the country. New York City is close enough. And I think you're going to find out pretty fast where to go and which direction to look. That website, when I used it months ago, seemed to tell me almost everything I want to know. You can select which satellite you want to listen to. An International Space Station is certainly the largest that I know of. Back to you, Lou.
I think you said it was going over now, so that was why I went to the quick one. I've got some other information I want to give you, but I'm going to run out with a quick look. I'll be back. It's working.
Very fine, Lou. You could use a tiny bit more rhodium. Come on back. Abel and I will probably be digging into his mailbag, although we really should also go over to Paul, that we have put him to sleep. WS2N, are you available? What's going on in space? Under the power vacuum. KQRIW in the tech desk. Okay, Paul did sign in earlier. He let us know that he might have a question. Maybe he got called away. Of all the subjects we discussed tonight, we went pretty far and wide. Anybody got any further questions or comments before we go over to Mel's mailbag? Give me a call at his name right now.
WS2OAY, concerning the stuff like I was talking about before, can I use a non-contact thermometer for a measuring device for that particular experiment with the water?
Okay, when you say non-contact, which really means usually it's infrared-like. Those infrared-like non-contacting thermometers are great when you measure something that's got a significant A over E index, absorptivity to emissivity ratio. That's a fancy way of saying black body. If you're measuring skin, which is a rather black body substance, at infrared frequencies, you aim an infrared beam at a human body, and a high percentage of energy gets absorbed. You aim the infrared beam at water, a high percentage of it gets reflected. Because it's being reflected, when you try to absorb the energy from the water proportional to its temperature, I'm not convinced you're going to come up with the right temperature. I think it's got to be a contacting thermometer, Joe.
Okay. I was just wondering if that would give me a fairly accurate reading, or reasonably accurate looking through, say, like the side of glass or something like that.
If the side of the glass was painted with something that's known to be a good black body material at infrared, and how would you know that, do you think? If you took a picture of it with an infrared lens, an infrared filter, on infrared film, aero-infrared ektachrome film, and if your particular glass or cup looks black, that would be beautiful. Those non-contacting thermometers, I think, operate by infrared, simply because the human body is very absorptive at infrared. Anything that's absorptive also is an efficient emitter at its temperature, at that wavelength. So water and cups, porcelain, glass, might not fulfill that requirement. You may have the right kind of Tupperware or whatever that would fulfill it, but it's going to take some experiment to find that out. You're into quite a few series of experiments here tonight, Joe. Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering about the microwave. I was listening to the oil on this stuff, and I find that pretty fascinating also. And I don't know anywhere near as much as you do about that subject. I find that quite interesting listening also. And a question in reference to that. For the average guy who does not know a lot about oil burners, how do you know how to trust somebody coming into your house that's going to make these measurements and do the right thing? How do you know what he's doing is right or wrong?
My experience, and this is a very heavily emotional charged opinion, my experience is a high percentage of the guys that are going to come in your house and act like experts are not. The amount of errors they've created that I have, quote, documented, is so huge, and the degree of error is so huge, I worry a lot. The only person you can really trust, in my opinion, Joe, is W-H-U-R-Y-Y. I don't know if there was a ham radio operator who used to live in Hempstead, can't think of his call letter or name right now, who was an oil burner service person. And a darn good one. He's now a silent key. If you can't find a ham radio operator, well, there are a couple of them here on. We signed in tonight who are in the business. KC2LTY, Rich. We've also got W2PNJ, Bob. And there was another one. We've got a couple of guys on frequency who seem to both be ham radio operators, work in the business, and therefore have knowledge. Also, if you walk into a store called Sid Harvey, You look in your phone book, and there's lots of individual Sid Harveys all over the place on Long Island. You walk into one of those stores, and most of the time they've got a book for a couple of bucks. It's a white book with black lettering, 8.5 by 11 size, about a third of an inch thick. Maybe I'm wrong on the price. Maybe it's $10 or $15, but it tells you a lot of information with beautiful diagrams. It's the instruction manual that teaches you how to educate the guy that's going to help you in your oil burner service business. And I own a copy of one or two of those. So that and libraries and websites, there's lots of information available. It's not rocket science. It's a simple oil pump that pumps the oil at 100 or 120 pounds per square inch into a nozzle. The nozzle has got a very exotic design. You're going to change it once every year. And it's a $2.50 item. But not change it when you're spending $1,000 for the oil you're putting in there. It's ridiculous. So it's a nozzle with a supply of air, squirrel cage, and a blower, and it burns the oil. That's essentially, and it's got a 10,000-volt transformer with a 3/16 of an inch arc between the two metal electrodes that creates the arc that lights the oil. That's the igniter. It's not rocket science here. It's got 1/100th the complication of your handy talking. So it's not that difficult to acquire the knowledge. Do it correctly with maybe a pair of rubber gloves on. You don't even get very dirty during the process. Once you've cleaned up your system, it's not going to be making black soot anymore. It's not going to be dripping oil all over the place anymore once you get it running correctly. To not do that and to waste, I'm going to pick a number, a few $100s per year because you haven't done that, to buy a service contract for $150 a year, which gives him the ability to charge you a higher price for the oil than if you buy it on the spot market, and then adjust your system in such a way that it wastes another $200 per year. Why do we keep doing that when there's a better way? I think you see what I'm saying here, Joe. Over to you, sir. Okay, Joe had no further comments on that. Mel? Have we gotten any interesting mail this week? I know we have. And would you like to go through one of those? K2KEY. Who burns gas? Guys cooking with gas. K2LIW. Who cooks with oil?
You timed out my link, so about the last 20 seconds was cut off. Sorry about that.
Okay, I said some great words to you, which you didn't hear. Sorry about that. Want to make any further comments, Joe, before we go over to Mel? You got it, Joe.
Well, you said you changed the tip on your burner to a 0.6. How do you verify that? Did you just go by, what the manufacturer says it's supposed to be, or did you actually buy something to measure the flow of oil per minute?
Good question, Joe. When you sit at Bid Hardy and you look at the shelf full of nozzles, you'll see 0.5, 0.6, 0.65, 0.7, 0.75, 0.8, 0.9, 1, 1.1. These are the gallons per hour stamped right on the nozzle. And you can buy it with 60-degree flare angle, 70, 85-degree flare angle, solid or hollow. So you make a choice whether or not the nozzle that is the right design for your particular burner is solid or hollow, what angle of deflection, and what gallons per hour. When you buy a 100-watt light bulb, do you worry about whether or not it's 110 watts or 95 watts? I know you don't. These nozzles should be changed every single year by clockwork, because the fine little grains in there are going to chew up that extremely fine orifice, and eventually it's going to lose some of its great quality to make a very finely atomized mix. And if you buy a 0.6 gallon per hour, and it has to be 0.62, it doesn't matter. It's the ballpark you're looking for. You're looking for 0.6 or 0.7 gallons per hour instead of the one for the 1.2 that was installed by your furnace manufacturer, which is dead wrong. It only makes it inefficient, soot producing, a raw making, loud device. You don't need any of that. The slight disadvantage, I mean, you talk to an oil burner service person on the job.
Call it.
He is dead set against going to a smaller nozzle. He loses sleep every night for fear that somebody's going to call him up on a minus 5-degree day, screaming and hollering at him that he can't get the house above 68 degrees Fahrenheit and his grandmother wants to live at 75. The fear of that situation will not allow him to lower the size of the nozzle one step. That's craziness. That's a one-day-a-year event. On that one day a year, I'll wear my ski jacket. And by the way, it's never happened. I will admit that when you go to a smaller nozzle, in the winter on a cold day, instead of the oil burner running 40% of the time, it's going to run 55% of the time. Big deal. It's running more efficient and quiet. When it does that, you don't know it's running. That's not something to fear. You tell an oil burner serviceman, do you want a smaller nozzle? They'll give you 40,000 excuses as to why they're not going to do it, and they're going to get mad at you because you're climbing into their business, and they think they're doing something that's rocket science. Craziness. Back to you, Joe.
LTY.
Can't you still hear you? LTY recognized the Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. It sounds like what you're summing up, what you're saying is, I should go get the book and start reading about this stuff first and become a little more educated about it, which I'll do.
Absolutely. Rich, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say the firing rate of the nozzle at the 0.60 or 0.100 gallon per hour, those figures are based upon a 100 PSI supply of oil.
And almost everybody's pump is set at 100 pounds per square inch, plus or minus a little bit. And what we're finding out from Rich and from Irwin and others, and Bob, that there's quite a bit of benefit to set it higher. We want very fine atomization. We know we're going to have to readjust the gallons per hour in the air supply, but we're willing to do that to get more efficient operation of the system. And if there's any further questions or comments, give me a call later.
N2EO, Dick. Good, it's the way you're
QA. Okay, N2EO, somebody who speaks super fast and I keep missing him. Rich first, go ahead, into Rio.
Okay, Dick. You know, somebody, a ham I know years ago taught me something very interesting. The call is W2 Victor Zulu Quebec, W2CZQ, Andy Cola. He owns a company called Cola Oil down by Kennedy Airport. I may be fired now, I don't know. But he was a good oil mechanic, and what he told me a good trick to do was to take an old-fashioned electric clock and fire it across the pump. This way you can see how much the oil burner is firing and get an idea how much efficiency you've got. Back to you, Dick.
Well, you got a problem there, Rich. As you follow my advice, you go to smaller number of nozzles, smaller gallons per hour. Your runtime will increase. That's good, not bad. Yes, if you're making changes of the fuel-air ratio but keeping the gallons per hour constant, then yes, that's a good test. So, there's a couple other variables here. There's another person who wanted to sign in. Who was that?
Greg, KC2QQA.
Okay, Greg, KC2QQA, you got it.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little bit what I've noticed with the oil burners. Mine was rated at 222,000 BTU with a 2.0 tip in it. And I changed it to a 1.0, which did make it run quieter, and it was much more efficient. But essentially, I cut my unit down to a half of a 222 BTU. I brought it down to 100-something BTU. And it was fine. That's what I'm on the bus to say. It does run a little longer, not a huge amount longer, a little longer, and I noticed much more efficiency. But now I just recently purchased a wood-burning boiler that I'm going to add to the system and hopefully eliminate my oil usage altogether. But that's what I've noticed. If you cut down the tip, you cut down your BTU output, which is okay. It'll just run a little longer. You know, I wish to put a 0.6 in there. I don't think I'd get away with it.
I hear you. I think I'm running a 0.6 in my hot water heater, and I think I'm running a 0.7 or 0.75 in the furnace that heats the whole house. And I know I could go smaller yet. I've never, on a cold day, got to the point where the furnace runs 100% of the time. And by the way, the thermal mass of your house would amaze you. During one of the power outages, when we had no power for a couple of days, I decided, hey, this is a beautiful time to do an experiment. It was like, as I remember, something like 35 degrees outside. I measured the temperature of my house every half hour for the next, I think it was 20 hours. I came to the conclusion that my house has a thermal time constant of 13 hours. In other words, 67% of what's going to happen in the temperature change, if there was a constant temperature outside, happens in 13 hours in my particular house. My house happens to have rather poor insulation. I've sealed up the holes where the air used to run in. Let me drop. And what I should do increase the insulation in the ceiling. I've got a very large piece of sliding glass door that should be a double-sided, double insulated glass. It's a single piece of glass. I put a heavy drape in front of it, but I really shouldn't replace that. There's a number of things I can do to insulate my house very well. I haven't done any of those things yet. Just sealed up the air leaks. But on cooling, I've got a 13-hour time constant. On heating, I think my time constant is something in the vicinity of 2 hours. In other words, for the temperature change, when I'm on the way up in temperature, when the house has been cold soaked for a while, I seem to remember it was 2 or 2.5 hours. You don't get instantaneous heat. Even if I had a great big nozzle, it still would be a fairly big number. But ordinarily, when you don't have a great big power outage, or if you've got a standby generator, you're not going to get one, that long thermal time constant on the way up is not as bad as you think. But you'd be amazed how much mass there is in your house of things that have to cool off. the walls, the furniture, the tables, whatever, all the metal objects in your head room, a lot of those things store heat. And so it takes 13 inspection hours, as I remember the cool rule. So going down to a smaller nozzle, almost everybody can do it. And the number of people I visited where there's this loud roar when the furnace runs and the whole house shakes. I say to them, how in the world do you dominate and you tolerate that? Well, they sort of ignore it. It's always been there. Of course, it's always been there. It doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't have to be, in my opinion. And that roar, that continuous vibration, I guarantee it's doing things to you about to your chimney that you wouldn't like. It's going to artificially age it. And eventually it's going to get leaked. And that roar is probably being accommodated with simultaneously it's got a poor fuel air mixture and you're making a lot of soot and a certain amount of carbon monoxide. And if there's a leak anywhere in the system because of the vibration and some of that leaks into the breathable air of the house, in my opinion, that's not good. Even though it may not go to a dangerous level, the fact that there's any carbon monoxide in the house at all is something definitely to be avoided. It can definitely create all kinds of chronic illnesses, in my opinion. Anybody have any further questions or comments? Give me a call, Eddie. Say that again.
Put a muffler on the boiler.
I guess you could put a muffler.
I mentioned one more thing.
Okay, I guess you could put a muffler on it. But if the roar is coming from a cyclic kind of incomplete burning, because the nozzle is too large with the amount of air being supplied, and there's a resin in the flue pipe system and whatever, you will definitely shift that resonance by going to a smaller nozzle with the right airflow, in my opinion. Mel, you've got it. You can discuss any of those subjects and or the mailbag, K2, K-E-Y, K2-L-I-W.
Okay, this is K2 K-E-Y. Well, I wasn't really going to pursue this any further, but just something that came to mind. All the new house construction around me here, they have the heating system of the houses in the floors, the plastic pipe that's supposed to be left forever. I mean, they bury it into the flooring and then they put the tile on top of it. I'm wondering if you compare. Of course, the houses are very well insulated. That I did do. I really put a lot of effort into insulating this house quite a bit. A lot in the attic, 15-inch insulation in the attic, you know, really piled up a lot of stuff in there. And the walls had blown in the fiber. Cellulose was blown into the walls there. Got outer windows, seals, inner windows, then shutters, all kinds of things. And then I have steam heat. Now, which did they ever evaluate which is the best, whether steam heat, hot air, hot water, or whatever, hot air, or hot, what do they call that, ventilated? In other words, anything ever was described as a favorable system, because a lot of people around here said that you want to get rid of those radiators, but I think they're wonderful over.
In that situation, Mel, good question. It's a little bit like saying, gee, I bought this quartz heater for the room of my house, an electronically fired quartz heater, and you read the manufacturer's specification, and it claims 100% efficiency. And you say to yourself, how can that be? Nothing's 100% efficient. Oh, every watt of power you put into that quartz heater becomes heat in the house, except for the little bit of optical energy that maybe goes out the window because you mounted the quartz heater near a window, except for the little bit of optical energy that goes out the window, every bit of it's in the house. So, whether you heat the air in your house and the floors in your house with water pipes that goes through the floors, with baseboard radiation and water fires, ordinary old-fashioned radiators, or hot air, every bit of the watt you put into that medium, the water that goes into the pipes in the floor, the water that goes into the baseboard radiators, the warm air that you fire through the ductwork, or the hot air or steam that you put into the radiators, every bit of that heat is going into the house. How it gets there doesn't matter. You can talk about how even the heating is. Maybe you like the fact that you're heating all 2,500 square feet of your house because you're doing it with the water through the zigzag piping in the floor. And therefore, the heating is more even. as opposed to warm air or hot air heating, where you're doing it with the ducts, and if you park the chairs and you're a duct, you're going to be a little bit hotter in a winter day than your pocket midway between the two. So the heating is a little bit uneven. We could talk about the unevenness, but when it comes to efficiency, I don't see how they can be any different. You're coupling the thermal energy from the medium, whether it be air or water, you're coupling it into the air and the appliances inside your house. The only place you can talk about the inefficiency is at the furnace, at the heat exchanger. Is all the heat of the flame getting through that heat exchanger into the medium, whether the medium be warm air, hot air, or water. Let me drop. Let me drop for a long enough period of time. Don't want to cut Joe out. When I bought the furnace that I fell in love with, because the ham radio operator, who was in the business, living in Hempstead at the time, told me what brand name of retention head oil warm air burner to buy, and I bought that brand name. Has a very nice thick heat exchanger that doesn't develop cracks and leaks like the other one did. I was putting soot into the house and making me see where all the rafters were in the ceiling, because of the way the soot was deposited on the ceiling in between the rafters, because of the difference in temperature up there, if you know what I mean, because of poor insulation in the attic. There's a number of things that were wrong in the house when I bought it. Okay. I installed that furnace, and I fell in love with that brand name, but the flue pipe was on the wrong side. The ductwork was the wrong size. I had to make an adapter for the ductwork, and I decided to make the adapter, one side of it, out of clear plastic so I could see the heat exchanger device, the A-frame that I put in there when I installed the air conditioner. So I've got an unusual piece of ductwork where you can see into one side of it. I can look into the water dripping off the A-frame for the air conditioning that I installed later on. But the flue pipe coming out the wrong side means I've got a great big long piece of flue pipe that makes a U-turn, goes around back along the side of the furnace, and then into the chimney. That is a heat exchanger. That flue pipe runs hot. That heat would normally go up the chimney. So what heat did go through the heat exchanger into the warm air, the flue gases themselves, are now going through this great big long, large diameter piece of flue pipe, and it runs hot, and it's putting the heat of those gases into my house. Back in the days when I didn't have a earlier furnace adjusted properly, that piece of pipe used to fill up with black soot. Now it has a very light layer of tan-colored stuff that forms in there very slowly. I can clean my furnace once every 4 years if I want to. I don't have to clean it every year. So I fell in soft, in my opinion, by having the flue pipe on the wrong side. It gave me another heat exchanger, which probably increased the efficiency of my oil furnace by another 20% as a rough guess on my part, at a slight risk. Let me drop. And that is, when you got a longer flue pipe like that, and you're telescoping pieces of pipe, make sure there's a good set of screws at each junction of that pipe. When you've got a longer piece of pipe like that, you've got a higher probability of something going wrong and the pipe coming apart. You've also got a higher vulnerability. You've got to make sure that when people store cardboard boxes in the basement, that they don't do it up against one of those flue pipes. Once every year, I've got to do an inspection, and I find that sometimes family members will put a flammable object less than a couple of feet away from furnace into a flue pipe. And I've got to instruct them on that every couple of years. They make that mistake. So there's two vulnerabilities that I've got with the longer flue pipe. But I've got a much higher efficiency of heat transfer of what's going on in that flame into the heat of my house. And who cares if the heat is going into the basement? It drifts up through the floor and gets into the living quarters. So how you heat the house doesn't matter. The efficiency is all in the furnace, in that heat exchanger, in my opinion, ML. KQKUY, KQLIW.
Hey, now I only thought because these street radiators get nice and hot and then stay warm for quite a while. So I thought maybe that is actually like some kind of a residual storage system. In other words, not just warming up the air around it, but then staying warm, continuously warming the air while the furnace is in the off-cycle thing. That's why I have to bring up whether or not steam heat is still a viable way of heating a house if you don't see it for us anymore. None of the houses that are rebuilt or or new construction ever here to see if anybody's putting in steam pumping here for. So that's why I brought it up. I think we ought to get to the mailbag, Dick, because I got some comments that we get off the subject. I won't get into it, but getting a lot of criticism to take over.
Yeah, Bell, good touch. Let me drop. The TechNet is only 4 hours long. We don't cover enough subjects thoroughly enough. That's what the mailbag is telling you, Mel. We need more TechNet time to cover more subjects more thoroughly. That's a joke. Now, what you said is a very common opinion. You've got a heavy chunk of steel in that radiator, and once you heat up the radiator, it takes a certain length of time for it to cool. However, the radiator must obey conservation of energy. You put in some number of joules, 1 second, joules, BTUs, call it what you like, into that radiator. And whether the radiator dissipates it rapidly because it's a low mass object, or slowly because it's a large mass object, the number of watts out has to equal the number of watts in. I said watts, I should be saying, BTUs or joules. The amount of energy you put in and the amount of energy that comes out has to be the same. There is no way that radiator could be accumulating 10 joules today, 10 joules tomorrow, and do it every single day for the next year. There's just no way it can do that. So whether it dissipates it in 10 minutes or 10 hours, it doesn't matter. You're getting the exact same amount of output, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel.
QQA.
QQA, go ahead.
I just have one other question. I'm not sure if you guys would know. It's an air conditioner question. Kind of backwards from the air burner question. Can I ask it?
Hey, Greg, you can ask. And the price is right. No guarantee you're going to get an answer. But sometimes we got people listening that'll chime in. You got it, Greg.
I have a 33,000 BTU air conditioner through the wall unit. It always throws out. You could hang me in my house if you wanted to on the hottest day. But I noticed it hasn't been doing a good job anymore at all. So I took up the front, and I wasn't even feeling cold air coming out, but I did notice that the bottom 2 inches of the coils in the front of the air conditioner actually had ice over them. So it is doing something. It made it actually have ice over it. So I thought maybe it was a little clogged. I vacuumed it. I blew compressed air through it from a compressor. I really cleaned it out. No difference. It's just doesn't seem to be getting the cool air to the front of the unit. I don't know if it could be low on freon, but it is making ice somehow.